From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is Christopher Anderson. His new book is Mick, The Wildlife and Mad Genius of Jagger. It was a New York Times bestseller. Christopher Anderson has written biographies of Katharine Hepburn, Jackie Kennedy, President and Mrs. Obama, Hillary Clinton, Madonna, and so many others. Christopher Anderson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
How do you choose the subject for your books? Is it like personal interests and passions, market research? Do you get assigned? How does it work?
I never get assigned. I sometimes only wish. It's hard to come up with people who are iconic, and I use that word carefully. I mean, it's one of the most overused words, I think, today. Everyone is an icon, you know.
Especially me.
Star.
I'm the iconic host of From
there
the Bookshelf.
There you go. But it's, you know, in Mick's case, I have to say, I think it's kind of it's an understatement. But in terms of who I write about, the people I write about are the people who fascinate me, but who also, I think, occupy a kind of a special place, you know, historically, in the case of the Kennedys and the Clintons and the Obamas and the Bushes. I've written about all of them, of course, Kate Hepburn. But then in terms of popular culture as well, and I think... you know, when you're talking about, you know, who looms large on the cultural landscape over the last half century, legitimately you can say that's Mick Jagger.
Well, and I want to talk all about Jagger, but no, I still have questions about your process.
Oh,
and
sure.
Do you find yourself, I would imagine, writing often about people that you don't necessarily like?
You know what? I found a long time ago that you really have to embrace your subject. I wrote a book once. It was a true crime book back in the, because I've done a number of, 31 books actually, all told. And, it was called The Serpent's Tooth, and it was about a young man who actually blew up the family, SUV with, the family in it so that he could inherit the great fortune. Needless to say, I despised almost everyone in that story. It was of greed. It's just a tale of just kind of wanton greed from beginning to end. And I decided from that point on that really I had to find that kernel in the people I was writing about. In terms of people like, obviously, I'm a great admirer of Jack and Jackie Kennedy, and again, all the presidential couples I've done, and Kate Hepburn was a friend of mine, and I'm pleased to say that, you know, she cooperated on the two books I wrote about her. You know, but with Mick Jagger, for example, most recent case, you write about them, you see the dark side. I'm a warts and all biographer. I would never leave out the negative things I find, and sometimes there's plenty negative to write about, but that's what makes them complicated and interesting to me.
Yeah, well, now, and also, you like to write about couples, or at least you write about couples.
Yeah.
You have Tracy and Hepburn, you have Dana and Christopher Reeves, Jack and Jackie, William and Kate, just a few of those.
Right.
What's the appeal of that?
Because you're looking at the dynamic. You know, it's one of those situations where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, you know. It's sort of writing a biography of a couple is an interesting challenge. It's not just two separate biographies brought together. It is, in a sense. I mean, you trace the lives of these people, what brought them together as a couple, but then how they function and relate to each other and the impact they have on society as a whole. I mean, I don't think people have done enough of that. And so when I first started out doing that, that was Jack and Jackie back in 1995. You know, it's kind of astounding that nobody had really sort of looked, put the marriage of Jack and Jackie Kennedy under the microscope at that point. But they hadn't. And so I talked to, you know, their family, as I always do. My process is go to the family members, friends, you know, co-workers, the usual suspects, you know, and try to be the fly on the wall throughout their whole lives together. And it's an interesting, you know, task.
So you definitely want to do a lot of first-hand interviews when you're doing your book.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, with Jagger, I think I've been working on this thing, I've said before, for 43 years, you know. Because, you know, I started in 1969 when I covered the Altamont Rock Festival.
Wait, so you were at Altamont?
I was at Altamont, yes. I was covering it for Time Magazine. Mm-hmm. And it was in December. For people who don't remember, it was going to be the Stones' answer to Woodstock, you know, and also was to quiet the critics. Even then, they were getting criticized for very inflated ticket prices for their concerts. They wanted to give back to their fans, as it were. And, of course, Mick decided to hire the Hells Angels to provide security. Almost 500,000 people showed up out in Livermore, California, which the Altamont Speedway was really in the middle of nowhere. And mayhem ensued, you know, big surprise. I mean, there was the Hells Angels beat hundreds, if not thousands, of people to a bloody pulp. And there was a murder that was that I witnessed.
You could see it from where you were?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was close enough to not only see it, but the expression on Mick's face when it was all happening. And afterwards, when they took the body away of this young man named Meredith Hunter, who was stabbed to death right in front of the stage while the Stones sang Under My Thumb, I went with the people who were treating him on the scene. They brought his, he was dead there. They brought him up to this control tower. It's kind of an interesting setup there. It was a speedway, so there was a kind of an announcer's booth, if you will. And I just remember the sight of this body laid out there under a sheet with a bloody boot sticking out from under the sheet, and the sight of Mick Jagger and the rest of the Stones getting on their helicopter and, you know, leaving like it was the fall of Saigon, you know.
Well, did you think that was cold, or?
I thought they were frightened. Many of the performers were frightened. You know, Marty Balin of the Jefferson Airplane was knocked unconscious during the concert that he gave at the Altamont when he was singing. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young wouldn't even go on stage. They left. So it got to be a very frightening scene, and they wanted to get away. I think that Mick has had to kind of live down that, and the Stones to some extent, that night. You know, it's still there in people's memories.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it was immortalized on film as well.
Gimme Shelter, one of the classic documentaries, maybe the classic rock documentary, I think.
Well, yeah, you wrote about Jagger before in 1993, I think.
Yes.
And so why did you come back to Jagger? I mean, do you think of your books as ephemeral, you know, like extended periodical pieces, or do you think of them as this is a book that's going to be here forever? And if that's the case, why write about Mick again?
20 years had passed, and boy, was that 20 years. You know, a great deal happened in Mick's life. I think it's interesting when you're a young man, like Mick was when he made that statement, I'd rather die than be 45 and still singing
satisfaction. Yeah.
Right. He famously said that, and I was curious how long he would stick it out, you know, but he's managed to be on, you know, not only around for 50 years when so many of his contemporaries have either self-destructed or just faded away, but he's still relevant, and I think that's what's key here. I mean, Justin Bieber sort of worships Mick Jagger. The Maroon 5 just had one of the biggest hits, I think their biggest hit ever, with Moves Like Jagger last year. They're all paying homage to this this guy who's still in their midst, and I think is still quite relevant. As a matter of fact, the Stones have just announced that they're going to be releasing a Greatest Hits 50th anniversary album shortly. It'll be a couple of new songs on it. The new documentary is being released. Actually, two documentaries are being released. So, you know, they're still out there. They're not a nostalgia act. You know, they're not playing the lounge at your local casino. They're filling stadiums like they always did.
We're talking to Christopher Anderson, and his latest book is a biography of Mick Jagger. Do you think this Greatest Hits record, then, is in lieu of a new album?
I think they probably will do a new album, but they have to kind of scramble. I mean, the latest things that have been going on behind the scenes with the Stones, as you know, since Keith wrote his book and kind of shook things up. Keith Richards wrote his autobiography last year and said some very disparaging things, to say the least, about Mick. And it nearly broke them up, you know, and they lost some time to actually treat the 50th anniversary of the Rolling Stones the way it should have been treated, with the, you know, major tour and all of that. So now they're kind of playing catch-up ball.
So do you think Mick was truly hurt by these things that Keith said?
Well, you know, forever Keith has been you know, chiding Mick, you know, calling him, his nicknames are Brenda and Her Majesty. But in the book he said he never, you know, that Mick was incredibly annoying, that he no longer you know, had a sense of himself. Of course, he made these derogatory comments about mixed manhood, if you will. And I think it finally got the best of Mick. I mean, he really just really didn't know why Keith had to go out on such a limb, go to such great lengths, really, to criticize him. I think Mick, the funny thing is, here is a man who's you know, sexual appetites are legendary, and yet, and his relationships are very well known, and yet the one true relationship he's had is with Keith Richards. I think I think he really considers Keith his soulmate.
Yeah, yeah. So you think he was hurt?
You bet.
Yeah.
And I think it frightened Keith, because Keith spent 6 months apologizing.
Now, in your book, you mentioned that the Stones had gotten together with Mick Taylor, former Rolling Stone, and that possibly Bill Wyman was coming. Anything about that? Will we see a different Rolling Stones on tour this time?
Well, they're going back and forth. Separating the rumor from fact in this particular case is tough. I'm certain that they're going to put together some sort of a tour in 2013. There are two concert dates in New York and London that are planned for November. But again, they're still haggling over the money, so they haven't made the official announcement. But those seem pretty firm as well. So yeah, they're going to get out there now. Whether or not Bill Wyman is part of the mix, he said most recently that he won't be part of that. But we'll see.
Well, Bill Wyman is what? I think he's 99.
Something like that. You know, these years are. I mean, we know Mick just turned 69.
Yeah.
Jay Leno was having fun with the book. You know, I do point out in the book that they're. According to Carla Bruni, one of Mick's lovers, Mick told her that he slept with 4,000 women. And
me too, by the way.
But of course, haven't we all? But you know, Jay Leno said, "Well, you know, it doesn't sound so bad to him. I mean, just do the math. It's only 3 a year." Mick's an old guy, but come on.
Not quite that old. Well, you know, the longevity is one of the, you know, the trademarks of the Rolling Stones now. But let's, you know, you in your book, in the early part of your book, naturally, you compare them to the Beatles, and it's impossible not to compare the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, because they were both, you know, there at the same time. The Beatles got the edge on the Stones being the first ones, but the Beatles were often jealous of the Stones. I know John Lennon famously jealous of the fact that the Stones' attitude, I guess.
Yes.
But what if the Rolling Stones had only performed until 1970. What if they hadn't continued on? Do you think the Rolling Stones would be as well remembered today?
No. To put it bluntly, I think part of one of the reasons we're all kind of mesmerized by them is because they're still at it, you know, uh-huh. in such a major way. And there were so many hits following 1970, obviously. I mean, they adapted because Mick was willing to adapt. You know, he went through the street fighting man phase, and then the satanic phase, and then you know, he donned the whole glittery jumpsuit so he could not miss out on the David Bowie glam rock period when they had a couple of big hits. You know, Miss You, one of their very biggest hits, is considered by Keith, at least, to be a disco tune.
Mm-hmm.
And then never really kind of losing the essence of being who he was, Jagger as the front man for the Stones. It's something that obviously the Beatles could not pull off, this kind of sense of who they were and what their audience wanted, you know, without going too far astray. And I think that's definitely, that longevity is part of the appeal. It is funny when you mention the Beatles, because the relationship between the Stones and the Beatles has been so misunderstood. Yes, indeed, Andrew Oldham, their first manager, kind of invented the image of the Stones as the kind of the scruffy alternative to the more clean-cut Beatles. But in truth, they were all very good friends. You know, at one point, for a long time, they even timed the release of their records so that they wouldn't be competing in the marketplace. They traded ideas. They toyed with the idea of kind of combining their forces and sharing studio space. And John Lennon remained a very good friend, although there were those moments where he, you know, took a few shots at Mick. When I mean, I interviewed May Pang, who was John's mistress for a time. He lived with May for a while when he left Yoko Ono, famous Lost weekend period. And May told me that, you know, Mick would come over and, you know, the two guys, John Lennon and Mick Jagger, would sit on the floor and watch TV and eat Chinese food, you know.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like, I'd like to see that. Like it'd be a fly on the wall.
Yeah, I know.
For that one. Well, you know, you mentioned frontman. I mean, that's one of the key things about the Stones. The Beatles never had a frontman. The Beatles were always the Beatles, and everybody knew them all. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think, you know, everybody, even back in the 1960s, people knew Mick, and they didn't know any of the other ones. They might have known Keith, but probably not. Most of them, people knew Mick Jagger, and that was it.
You got it. That's right. That's true.
And in your book, you talk a little bit about how Brian Jones was the true frontman of the group, and Mick kind of stole that away. How did that happen exactly?
Well, Brian, you know, was he was a trouble from the word go. He had serious drug issues, and he was very violent, and he routinely beat up the women in his life, and he was just not a nice guy. He also would not show up. And I think had he been as disciplined as Mick was, and that's the one thing people have to realize, you know, Mick grew up, his parents shaped him, molded him. When his father and mother passed away just a few years ago, he wept in the church because he knew he still always wanted their respect. But I think, that's something obviously that a lot of people in the rock world don't have, is that sense of physical and mental discipline in addition to the artistic streak. So indeed, Brian Jones tried to maneuver Mick out first. We have to out of the group. You know, he went to the record company. He wanted Mick Jagger out, and Mick responded, in fact, by maneuvering Brian out of the group. And as we all know, Brian's death, a mysterious drowning, not so mysterious now because the man who drowned him had made a deathbed confession, indeed, the relationship between Mick and Brian and actually Brian and everybody else in the Rolling Stones was strained from the get-go.
Do you believe that deathbed confession? You really think somebody...
I do. I do, because it all tracks with everything else that's going on, you know. And if, once again, it gets rather complicated, but the situation, Brian went one step too far and angered too many people.
Now, did you ever talk to any women who said they were beaten by him?
No, I talked to people who, you know, knew that they'd been, by Brian Jones, we're talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, no, it was famously that he was, Mick Jagger, actually, and Keith Richards and a number of others have gone on record as saying that he left a trail of kind of bloodied girlfriends, and they were tired of cleaning up his mess.
We're talking with Christopher Anderson, and his latest book is Mick, The Wild Life and Mad Genius of Jagger. And genius, I guess, is like icon, a word that's tossed around a lot. But, I definitely think it would apply to Mick. But what about his musicianship? You don't talk a lot about him as a musician in your book. I mean, you tell us his stories of his wild sexual life.
I talk about what shaped him as an artist. That's early on.
You mentioned Marilyn Monroe. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the things that would come as a surprise to most people, I think, is that it's not really moves like Jagger so much as it is moves like Marilyn. Because early on, he was obsessed with Marilyn Monroe. In 1962, when they started the band, Marilyn Monroe died just a month after the Stones' first performance, and he just kind of became obsessed with her image and portraying her on stage. And yes, indeed, his musical influences were people like Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry and so on, Little Richard. But in terms of what he wanted to present on stage, it was Marilyn Monroe. And so you have, if you just look at him, even in the very beginning, this kind of pouty thing, the toss of the hair, the swivel hip thing, it's her.
I see it, but I'd never heard that before.
Oh, yeah. And the funny thing is that she's, as you can imagine, this shocked audiences to such an extent that they didn't really know what to make of it. And it was part of the reason I think they were able to whip up sort of a frenzy, not only among the female, but the male patrons in these kind of dank basement clubs that they started out in. It's also interesting, I think there's one little episode I find fascinating, and that takes place in the Dartford Grammar School, the high school, the private high school, I might add, that Mick attended. He was a captain of the basketball team, and during one kind of spirited game, he collided with another player, he bit off the tip of his tongue, swallowed the tip of his tongue, and the other members of the group that he played in then, it was called Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys, he was Little Boy Blue, swear that that changed the way he talked and the way he sang and performed. So, you know, some of these events that are little known but really kind of changed the course of musical history, I find fascinating.
Everywhere you want, I always go. I always give in because they know. To just say so, could she give me that feeling inside that I know I must be right? It's the singer, not the song. It's not the way you give in willingly. Others do it without thrilling.
In addition to saying some snarky things about Mick in his book, Keith Richards also says some really wonderful things about Mick as a musician. He calls him one of the greatest harmonica players that ever lived.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, he plays the piano, he plays a number of instruments, but and the guitar, but he is, and of course, let's face it, like so many people in popular music who are legendary, their voices aren't necessarily all that good. You know, it's style over substance, and I think he listened to the. Here's this guy from suburban London who ends up consumed by singing American blues in the beginning, so much so that when they picked the name the Rolling Stones, Jagger hated it, and in his first interview as a Stone, he said, I hope people don't get the wrong idea and think we're a rock and roll outfit.
That's funny.
He's the the ultimate rock and roll outfit.
So you are essentially saying that you think that even though he's known as a singer, you don't think he's a great singer. I mean, how would you classify him as a singer?
I'd say in the same way that I'd say that, Sinatra may not have had the most magnificent voice, the greatest range, the clarity of tone, but he had, I consider Sinatra to be one of the greatest singers of all time because of his phrasing, and I think that's also true in his own, in the context of the rock world, definitely true of Mick Jagger. I mean, his sound is unlike any other. I mean, he is, people talk about a real original. I mean, he is an original. And a force of nature, sort of, I think, in the rock world. I think that's all part of what makes him so appealing.
Well, of course, in the last 20 years, there have been far fewer albums of either Mick or the Rolling Stones.
True.
But do you consider him more of a live performer than a recording artist?
Well, when you look at the hits, the 200 million records, so it's easy to say that indeed the impact they're having now is on the concert stage, or for the last 20, 30 years. Because they've just set so many records. At one point, they had the number one, I think it was number 1, 3, 7, and 9 of all the top 10 grossing tours of all time. They have made $2 billion. They've grossed $2 billion in concert ticket sales. So, it's easy to say, yes, indeed, he has been seen by more people than anyone else on the planet, probably performing live at this stage. However, also 200 million albums sold. It's you can exhaust yourself just running down the list of this classic songs that Mick and Keith have written. You know, so I think both as recording artists and live performers, they're in a class by themselves. And songwriters, by the way, people keep forgetting that these guys. They've been inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame right up alongside Cole Porter and the Gershwins and the rest of them. I mean, that's how kind of revered they are by their fellow songwriters.
I guess another big difference between the Beatles and the Stones was that there was never a Hard Day's Night for the Rolling Stones. Although Mick is a pretty good actor.
I think he is. I think he's underrated. He certainly has tried. He made a film called Performance. That's, it was shocking to many people. As a matter of fact, one studio executive, allegedly a woman, during a screening, allegedly got so nauseous at some of the scenes that she was seeing there that she threw up during the screening.
Really?
So people were shocked. There were problems with the movie's release. And essentially, he was playing himself in the film, a rock star who, was kind of coming undone. He's a hedonist in the film. But I think his attempts to get a screen career off the ground, are very well documented. He played Ned Kelly, the Irish-born Australian folk hero bandit. It was a very embarrassing film, a big flop. He more recently has done some character roles in a couple of films. But, indeed, he has not, I think, had the success as an actor that he once dreamed of having.
And there's quite a few Rolling Stones concert movies, of course.
Sure, and big ones.
Yeah, and you say there's a new one coming.
There is. There are two, actually. One is Chronicles, one of their tours of Ireland in the 60s, and another...
About that one.
Yeah, it's going to be at the New York Film Festival in late September, I believe. And the other film is a documentary that's brand new, made up of never-before-seen footage, as they say. And I believe it's called Crossfire Hurricane.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's one Stones film that is rarely seen, and we can't say the title of it on the radio because it's Cocksucker Blues. You're not allowed to
that's
say
right.
it.
That's going to get bleeped, I think. Yeah, I know. Well, that's... I have seen it, and it's,
It's a bad movie, or it's a good movie?
It's a little bit like the Rolling Stones Circus. I'm just... look, to me, the gold standard is Gimme Shelter,
Yeah, that's a great one. Well, the book is called Mick, the Wildlife and Mad Genius of Jagger. It's the latest from Christopher Anderson, who has written 31 books about a wide variety of things, including science and crime and lots of wonderful biographies. And I hope that you will come back after the next book. What is the next book?
I never say. I'm kind of the stealth author, I like to say. I fly below the radar. You don't want to tip off the sources.
Oh,
or the subjects before too early in the game.
Well, whoever it is, will you come back and chat about it?
I would love to. It was great fun.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and you'll come back and see us again next time. Check out our podcast page at www.fromthebookshelf.com. I want to thank my guest, Christopher Anderson, his latest book, Mick, The Wildlife and Mad Genius of Jagger. From the Bookshelf production assistance is provided by Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.